be curious about the what if. What if we did do that, or what if we didn't do that? It's like the stuff we're talking about. What if we did open our fire department and put 100 beds in there and took 100 homeless people off the street? What's the worst that could happen? What if we did? And just ask the question. I think that's really promoting it, an open conversation about, well, what if, we have these amazing people, these amazing resources. What if we used them in this way? What if we did this with them?
Love that.
And the more you ask that, the more it becomes an organizational habit.
The First Responder Liaison Network is proud to present to you the Kitchen Table Podcast, where our guests come share their stories, their perspectives, and their message, talking all things leadership. Now here's your host, Berlin Mazza.
Welcome everyone to The Kitchen Table. The Kitchen Table is brought to you by the First Responder Liaison Network. The network is organized for the development, implementation, and ongoing support of mentorship and professional development programs, inspiring our youth and young adults to mature into engaged civic leaders and resilient community sentinels. Music and graphics are brought to you by Kai Elephant Productions. Today we go overseas for the first time on The Kitchen Table, to the United Kingdom. We're talking community risk reduction like we never have before. Our guest unpacks a philosophy that he implemented in his fire department in the UK. It's a concept that I had never heard of. It's a literal putting the community first philosophy. So stay tuned. This is going to be a great conversation today. We're also going to talk about how everyone need be a customer of the fire service, the 0-2-5-20 model. And our guest today joined the fire service in 1976 and served in 4 United Kingdom fire services. He was one of the primary founders of the community risk reduction concept, developed in the UK in 1999, and have seen the growth of the concept across the world. Our guest has worked in the UK, the USA, other parts of North America, Europe, Australia, and New Zealand. Our guest received the Queen's Fire Service Medal in 2006. And was made a commander of the British Empire in 2012. He retired in 2013 and lived in Australia managing the disaster and crisis response for the New South Wales EPA, a state that is slightly larger than Texas. Since retiring, our guest has spent time working for the EPA and have seen the impact of global warming firsthand. The changes required to meet this challenge will require fire departments to radically think about their role and whether their role in the future is as a response agency to all environmental incidents. Lithium batteries have changed the fire profile in all communities, and most fire departments have struggled with how to respond. Community risk reduction is a 20th century concept, and we need a 21st century concept, which is a leaner, more flexible, and does not rely on data. Good morning, Chief. Thanks for being a guest on the Kitchen Table today. How are you?
I'm great, Berlin, and nice to meet you, and thank you for the invitation. I really appreciate it.
Benjamin May, who was on the show last summer, and he leadership challenged you. And I say this a lot on the show, but the best part perhaps of the podcast is that we get to gather perspectives and then the individual gets to help us further it. So that's how we're here. And thank you so much. So I do say good morning here, but it's probably not good morning there. So before we get going, what time is it there? And where are you joining the Kitchen Table with us today? And also tell us a little bit about Chief Tony McGurk before we go.
Hi. Well, I'm in Portugal on the Algarve. It is just past 5:30 in the evening here with a beautiful sunset, and it's a gorgeous part of the world. Great food, great wine, great people. I've been coming here for sort of got a second home here for a few years, and it's a great place. A lot of American visitors really starting to discover Portugal as a place to visit and to live. So the secret's out and a lot of Americans are coming over. But so my background, I joined the fire service nearly, was it 40, 50 years ago now? And seen a lot of change in many ways. Became a chief in the sort of late 90s, served in a few different fire services and ended up as chief in Merseyside, where Liverpool is the main city, a very old city, it goes back to the 12th century. and is seeing, you know, the good times and the not so good times. And what it was left with was a city with a, you know, incredible wealth, but also incredible poverty. And, you know, one as a fire chief, the sort of most obvious thing that to me we needed to address was the very high levels of fire death and fire injury. We had some of the highest levels in the Western world, even though we spent more per head of capita on the fire departments, on the fire service, than most of the fire services. And so there was no relationship between the money spent on the fire service and the level of fire injury and fire death. And that was a sort of quite a challenging issue to address. Certainly not a popular issue to address, because it sort of, in a way, flies in the face of the culture of the fire service. And it's in no way a criticism of the courage and the bravery and the amazing people who work in our industry. But unfortunately, you know, the world moves on. You know, firefighters don't exist in a vacuum, and the world had changed around us. But our model hadn't changed. Our model was still very much response-based. And that isn't going to solve the problem we had. It certainly wasn't in Merseyside. So we really flipped the whole idea on its head and said, no, our job is to prevent the fire happening in the first place and to help the homeowner and the community do that in whatever way is required. And so that's, we started that project in 1998. And I, as you mentioned, Ben had been a long time friend. In the UK, to be a fire chief, you have to have attended a National Fire Command course. And as part of that course, you've got a lump of money to go and study or research an aspect of fire that was interesting. I went to the US. I spent a week in the Phoenix Fire Department with Chief Brunicini and his guys there. What a fantastic department that was. I spent a week between Emmitsburg and Fairfax, Virginia, to look at, you know, the NFPA, IFC, Emmitsburg and Fairfax Fire Department. Through all of that, I connected with Ben, who at the time worked for Disney, but was incredibly passionate about the fire world. And so the research I was looking at was the role of marketing in the fire service and what marketing can offer as a sort of social marketing approach. And from that, I took those lessons back to the UK. We adopted them in our community fire safety, as we called it, project. And then around about, I guess, 2002, 2003, got invited back. There was a major conference in Washington, D.C., called 2020, Vision 2020. And the United States Fire Administrator, who at the time, I think, was Glenn Gaines, was interested, where are we going to be in 2020? You know, what can we learn from the rest of the world around, you know, how are they dealing with this fire problem? And so I attended that to talk about what the UK were doing. And from that, a Vision 2020 group was established in the US, bringing lots of partners together. And I think Laurie was on that group, who's now the fire administrator. But the group really started to set this clear strategic vision of where does the US fire department want to be in 2020? And that from that, was the idea of community risk reduction emerged. Uh-huh. And as you see today, it's led on to an NFPA standard, a whole range of initiatives, projects, and innovation in the US around community risk reduction. So that's where I guess really my connection with the US started.
Wow. So I guess we'll just jump here right away. We're in obviously 2024. So going back to when this project organization formulated in 2002-ish, we're 22 years later. Compared to where they thought we would be 22 years ago to where we are now, what was the prediction and are we there? Did we meet it? Are we behind or are we ahead?
I think probably a little ahead, if anything. I think a lot of people thought there would be more resistance to the concept. There's a phrase, and I don't know if you got it in the US, called turkeys voting for Christmas. If your turkey's voting for Thanksgiving, you know, the last thing a turkey needs is Thanksgiving because they're on the dinner table. And so the idea of firefighters putting so much effort to effectively putting themselves out of a job was met with a lot of resistance in some areas in the UK, and I think the US colleagues felt there would be similar resistance. I don't think there was. I think the way so many fire departments had embraced the co-responder or medical response dispatch role in the US, which isn't the case in the UK, I think American firefighters and departments were more willing to take on new initiatives if they could understand the why. You know, I think the Institute of Fire Engineers were the lead agency, and I think because it wasn't a conventional partnership, you know, typically, you know, who would lead? The fire chiefs, IFC would take a lead, or, you know, NFPA, but it wasn't. They were all part of this coalition, but there was a dedicated Institute of Fire Engineers, which I think, because they were quite agnostic, they were just looking at the problem. There was no real agenda there around their own organisation. I think it helped cut through some of the barriers, and they were able to bring a sort of coalition type model together, and things moved on pretty quick. I think also the US, particularly NFPA, are really good at moving into a sort of standard. Well, we need a standard against which we can measure and benchmark performance. And so I think that gave focus and momentum to the sort of project aims. I think unfortunately the problems moved. I think if the problem in 2020 had been the problem everyone thought it would be, great. Unfortunately, new technology around a carbon net zero ambition has come along, and it's really disrupting the whole industry.
Yeah.
And not in a good way.
Going back just a little bit, and I do want to jump into what you're talking about innovations and carbon energy. We'll talk about lithium ion batteries. I'm sure we will. But when we're talking about, let's go back to the fundamental level now, as we're talking to, you know, emerging leaders in the fire service. Back in 98, the 98, 99 timeframe, when the conversations were happening about the community risk reduction concept, what were the initial initiatives or goals or objectives? What areas? So what were those conversations about?
That's a very good question. The conversations were about what are we going to do and why are we going to do it? What's different to what we do today? And the challenge with vision is you can't write a vision down, otherwise it wouldn't be a vision. So trying to share vision through text is incredibly difficult. Very few people can do it. And the ones who can tend to make a lot of money. J.K. Rowling, for example, you know, the picture she paints in words of the vision of these incredible characters, when you make a movie and those images, the vision lives up to your expectation from the written word, that's really skillful. That's a very, very unusual skill set. We didn't have that. So we had to try and present a very clear vision of what we were trying to achieve that every firefighter could align with. That doesn't mean agree with.
Right.
Not every firefighter agrees, but at least it can align with the aims of the vision. And the vision was prevent the fire in the first place. That's got to be better for everybody to not have a fire. And if we do have a fire, we've got to detect it really, really quickly to give the person the best possible means of putting it out. That's our aim. Put it out.
Yep.
And then again, not every firefighter or every agency aligned with that vision. Most want people to run away and get out and call the fire department. Why would you do that? Who on earth would do that? You've just spent all your working life to build a home and build a family, and because your barbecue's on fire, you're going to run out and leave your house to burn down. Only an idiot. Why would anybody?
Right.
And the truth is, people don't. There is no research whatsoever I've ever come across, and I've looked, that supports the idea, get out, stay out, and call us out. That is a political message.
Mm.
And so being truthful about my beliefs around that message helps align the vision. So then the next stage is put the fire out. If you can't, then get you and your family out quickly within 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. So let's have a window that you're going to do stuff in. And then the first 20 minutes of that fire, there's lots you can do to protect your family, protect your possessions, make it easy for the fire department. What are those things you can do to minimize life disruption to you and your family because you've had a fire or a disaster or an event? So that clarity really helped firefighters. So how are we going to do it? Well, from tomorrow, your job is instead of watching TV, you're going to get on the fire truck, drive down the street, knock on the door and say, I'm firefighter so-and-so, can I please come in and tell you about our new initiatives that's going to make you and your family safer? It just take a few minutes of the time and there's a free gift. Well, what's a free gift? I'm going to give you three smoke alarms, as many as you need to make your home safer. And when I leave after this visit, you'll feel really good about safety, fire safety, and your home will be protected. Can I come in, please? And guess what? People let you in the door.
Yeah.
So that was the initiative. No data, none whatsoever. We didn't need it. I never felt we needed it, and I still don't think you need it. All I did was get a group of firefighters over coffee and say, right, where's all your fires? That's where we'll start. They don't need mosaic or, you know, spreadsheet. They know where the problem is. Now, if you have limited resources, so if you're going to say we've got 1,000 smoke alarms, so which homes should we prioritize, then there is a need to a degree to subdivide, to be more granular in that analysis.
Sure.
My response, well, why? Smoke alarms are so cheap. Buy more smoke alarms. Why on earth are you rationing the one thing that will save their lives, and yet you spend $1 million on a fire engine, which by definition doesn't move until they've had the fire and told you about it? Why on earth are you not putting all your resources into the smoke alarms? Sell some fire engines and use that to buy some smoke alarms. And that's what we did. Huh. So it's all... But to do those things authentically, and I think leadership is about authenticity, you have to have the courage of your conviction. Yeah. Otherwise, you're a fake. People will very often disagree with strong opinions and a conviction, a strong view, but they won't take it personally if that person genuinely believes they've got a, and it's a reasonable thing you're talking about.
Yeah.
But to have the courage of your conviction, you have to have the conviction.
Yes.
So agreed. If you believe these things are true, you can't fake that.
Yeah.
And a data-driven problem analysis doesn't bring any passion. It doesn't bring any, there's no buy-in to data. It's just data. So, oh, well, if you look at it on a Tuesday, it's different to a Wednesday. You just get consumed by the minutia, mm-hmm. in my opinion. And I think one of the challenges with the US model is got very data consumed, because the US typically love data. So, but you guys like, you're more into technology than perhaps some other countries, certainly UK, you know. So yeah, I guess the point I was making is I think data is important to a degree. I think we're overstretching its importance. Yeah. And I think professional judgment is just as valid.
Yeah.
And B, you know, sometimes things are self-evident. You know, if I drive down the street and every other house is burnt out, do I really need to do any further analysis to tell me I've got a problem here?
Yeah.
You know? But I made the point, you know, the world has changed. What we did find with the data, fires are very, very predictable, or were. And they're completely linked to poverty and lifestyle.
Sure.
So the randomness of fire is very, very, was very, very rare. Now it isn't. Lithium batteries have brought a randomness that's very, very difficult to predict. And I think it is quite a fundamental game changer to the fire service, the model, the way we approach fire cover, fire response, and fire reduction.
As far as like the smoke alarm concept and talking about, you know, why don't we go out and just spend money, if you will, on the preventative side? What was your position in the fire department at that time when this was, when you guys were implementing these concepts, if you will?
I was the chief, so there's one fire chief. I reported to the police, so we had a political board.
Okay.
And so I reported directly to them. And we set an annual budget.
Okay.
And so the way it worked, we would spend a couple of $1 million a year on smoke alarms within a very, very constricted budget window.
Yeah.
So the only way to release the money was to have less firefighters. Firefighters in the UK typically cost about $70,000. So one less firefighter buys a lot of smoke alarms for that year.
So how
So
did, yeah.
manage it, sorry.
I was just going to say,
It
how
wasn't
did
popular.
that, was it the initial implementation, if you will, how did that go over with the fire department, your fire department, but the fire service, if you will, in the UK, or I guess specifically in the area that you were working in, if you were one of the first aid departments, if you will, in the fire services over there implementing a lot of this community risk reduction, was it frowned upon? Was it fought back on? Was there so much pushback that many other organizations around you did not, implement the same concept because, the philosophy, here, especially like labor unions we'll use for example, like every reduction in workforce is a negative. So I'm just kind of curious on, was there any pushback to the sense that, maybe we don't want to do this because this?
Absolutely. I mean, no, the fire department adopted it initially.
Okay.
We had huge industrial unrest from
Okay.
the trade unions. I think we had at one time about 230 disputes. So the dispute, we have a dispute system. Everything was disputed. We used a product called No More Nails Glue. So the union took an injunction against the use of this glue to stick up smoke alarms,
Yeah.
through to instructing their members not to
Right.
undertake work. All the usual noise you get, and I've worked in the US, all the tools that the trade unions got to sort of
Yes.
signal disruption and to stop change. And the UK's got exactly the same sort of models. In addition to that, no other fire chief agreed. They just thought the answer was more fire engines. Again, not really any logic to that, but it's this point, the courage of conviction. You either believe it's true, it's not. And I said to the so when I became the chief, I was the only candidate for the job. I was the highest paid fire chief in the UK. Why is there's only me applying for it? There's a clue there. So, and the deal was, give me a little bit of time, these are my aims. And we will reduce fire death and fire injury in the first year by, a significant percentage, a minimum of 20%, probably near 40 to 50%. You
Wow.
just got to hold your nerve politically,
Wow.
and don't get in the way, to be honest.
Did
And if we haven't done, then I'll leave.
that statistic, I'm just curious, real quick, Chief, did that statistic hold up in your first, say, few
Yeah,
years?
40%
Wow.
first year. So, and that is irrefutable evidence.
Yeah.
If you set out to, and the truth is, we should learn to trust our firefighters. Just because a union expresses a view, a union is a single product business. They have one asset, one product, and that's membership. Of course, if I were them, you have to fight any threat to your revenue, and that's so anybody who tries to reduce your membership,
Yes.
then of course you've got to fight. It doesn't mean it's true.
Good point.
It's like Pepsi or Cola. It's a flavor, it's a taste. But if you're Pepsi, you'll say, ah, well, Cola's a rubbish product, blah, blah, blah. It's just a product. So I never get confused about that rhetoric over here and the real world. Firefighters are incredibly passionate about their role. And if you take the time to engage with them as colleagues and fellow professionals, honestly and truthfully, and explain why you think this will work, and accept, don't lie to them,
Right.
accept, and it's going to mean less firefighters, but the way I'm going to do it, nobody's going to lose a job. If we start now, over the next 5 years, lots of people retire and just not going to replace them. So I will intentionally, we will probably have people who die, who we could probably save,
Yeah.
just so we take a measured approach, because that sensitivity is really important. And you know what? Firefighters said, no, go for it. We're not going to have that in our conscience. Most firefighters.
Huh.
Won't stop them going on strike, by the way, because that's a different mechanism. You know, going on strike is just a way. It's like when kids sort of slam the door. It's a tool to display disgruntlement and unhappiness. You know, fine, I accept, you know, it's like out with your kids, you know, not every decision I make as a parent, my kids
sure.
love.
Sure.
But it's made for the best of reasons. And, you know, usually in hindsight, people say, well, I can understand why you made the decision, but it was about as popular as a fart in a space suit. It was not popular.
Not at all.
At all. But then, facts are awkward things, aren't you? Once the data's proved dramatic reductions in fire death and fire injury,
yeah. Yeah.
Then the government changed the law.
Yeah.
And we have a national legislative framework in the UK, and they changed the job of the fire service, which used to be to respond to fires. The job is to make communities safer.
Right.
Which includes respond to fires, but it isn't exclusive to response.
Agreed.
And, you know, 5 years later, every fire chief in the country thinks it's their idea and is fully on board, and rightly so. But it wasn't always like that. And I think the changes we've got to face up to in the future will be as unpopular. And not just with the fire service. You know, the world is changing very, very quickly. And I think the fire service, I think the fear in the fire service is we're going to lose relevance. Everyone wants to feel listened to and heard and relevant and have a voice. And I think the fire service has been allowed to form a sort of definition of having a voice and being listened to is being agreed with.
Mm-hmm.
So if the firefighters and their union disagrees with something, they're really good at applying political pressures and pulling political levers to get their own way. And that's great. Of course, you're going to be in that union to get me more money. You know, yeah. They usually win. They're very good at it. And it's much harder for the chief to win in that sort of
sure.
confrontational environment because the chief is the point of least resistance. The union personalize it against the chief. You go to the city manager or the mayor and say, if only you get rid of the chief, we'll all be friends again. So they get rid of the chief and everyone's friends and the problem goes away. But that was never the problem in the first place. So change drivers in the US, I think, need a lot of courage. Job security is a real issue. You know, what fire chief is going to put his job on the line if they're not confident of winning? But if they were confident of winning, they wouldn't need to put the job on the line. So it's a vicious circle. So unless circumstances change around you, which make change inevitable, it's very difficult for the leader to drive the change quickly.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the great things about the CIR agenda in the US. Now, there's a sort of safe place where the fire chief can go and talk about change and a different model for the fire service. I think that's an amazing step forward for US fire departments and fire chiefs.
Well, so a question I have on that is, talk about, as you mentioned, leaders, you talked about labor unions, you talked about the fire chiefs. So from a leadership standpoint, talking about like a community risk reduction concept, when talking about where there might be not just a reduction in workforce, but we'll say measures to be put into place, initiatives that would prevent, say, not get rid of firefighters, but say prevent the hiring of, at least for a period of time, to invest the money into prevention efforts, we'll say. From a leadership standpoint, how does a fire chief, how does an executive chief, how does a labor union, you know, leader, how do they navigate those decisions and conversations when they're both knowing that the greater good is the prevention and safety of community and firefighters? How does that take place, knowing that both sides, for example, have an agenda, right? The labor union leaders are fighting for jobs, job security, so forth. The fire chief and the board is looking for just, you know, firefighter safety and just, you know, community safety, so on. So how did you navigate that? What were your relationships and conversations like with labor unions and so forth to push initiatives like this through?
I think it is very difficult if you overanalyze the conversation discussion framework. You know, sometimes, and that's why I use the phrase self-evident, sometimes things are pretty obvious. You know, step one, do we agree we've got to, something's got to give? So we, you know, our job is, the fire and rescue service. So do we agree our aim is to make the community safer in terms of fires and rescues? So if we do, what does safer mean? It means less people getting injured, killed, burnt, or maimed. Surely, unless you've got a different definition. Cool. Then we agree. What else is there to talk about? Because the how is my job as the chief. The rest of you, that's the job of the leader, to set the how agenda. And then once you've got that leadership direction, you can start to sort of play with it and mold it and, you know, make it more owned, but without a starting point. And that's one of my favorite quotes, I think we chatted earlier on, was Arthur Ashe. You've got to start from where you are.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to work with what you got and you've got to do what you can. You know, so you can talk in the third party, if only we had more money, if only, you know, if only, but that's not where we are.
Yeah.
And I think if you're clear about where you are and where you need to be and what have you got to get there, then those are the variables. There's only so much you can do with that, isn't there? You know right. what I mean? Otherwise, you can't promise the earth when you can't deliver it. So I think the leader's got the luxury of being able to set the agenda, but they've also got the accountability of delivering that agenda yes. that they set. And communicating what it is. I think the more complicated you make it, the harder it is
sure.
to get buy-in to the overall strategy. Don't get sucked into the how too much. Once you've agreed the what you're going to achieve, the how are just the component parts of getting there. But if you instinctively think this is very, very achievable, I think that's the skill of the leader, knowing when you're in a, you know, you're saying, you see it now with the climate agenda, you know, we're going to get rid of, we're all going to be driving an EV vehicle by 2025. Just ridiculous. That's not going to happen. So professional leaders can't get caught up in the rhetoric of politics.
Yeah.
That's not their job. It's to be authentic about leadership, not political leadership, unless they are political leaders.
Yeah.
But most leaders probably listen to podcasts are probably going to be leaders in or around the emergency services. And they're very clear what their job is to me. Why would you join a service like ours unless you really want to save people's lives or improve their lives in some way?
Yeah.
And don't look for too much agreement if you have a passionate belief that this is a really, and that's why we've mentioned lithium batteries a few times. This is a really inconvenient truth, this problem. It really is inconvenient. They blow up at random in an unpredictable way. And so if you've based 200 years of models around a level of predictability and you position your people and resources based on that and suddenly gets rid of all of that, you've got a real problem. And the added component of the problem is, and it's not going to be popular to say, these batteries are a bit of a death trap. You know what I mean? They're a really necessary technology, but that doesn't mean they're a good technology. They're a rubbish technology. They just happen to be the only game in town. So we've got to do what we can, but trying to cover up the fact that it's a rubbish starting point seems to me silly. It's a rubbish starting point. Let's agree that. And then we don't need to disguise or, you know, give the illusion this stuff is, oh, it's all manageable. You know, the manufacturers are all, what a load of rubbish. It isn't. This is about the randomness of fire.
Right.
And we've never really had that. It's the sort of terrorist that I missed in a way, because these can be incredibly damaging to people's lives and their property suddenly without warning and random. And that's a very rightful place to be. So I think the fire service, alongside coming up with some answers, has got to do it in a confident way that instills community security and confidence and assurance that we've got this. We've always had this problem. And what the fire service is brilliant is responding and moving with the being contemporary. And we've got this.
Yeah.
I don't see that. I see a lot of reticence and a lot of fear. You know, oh, these battery energy storage systems, you know, they blew up and put 9 firefighters in hospital. Which is awful, it's true. But, you know, we've had 13 firefighters die in a wildfire with less media attention. You know, And I don't wish to demean or in any way play down how terrible it is when firefighters get injured. I just think the fire leaders of today have just got to rise a little bit above the rhetoric and say, so what is our plan? What are we going to do about these batteries that will, A, solve the problem, B, give clarity of strategy to our teams and our resources and our communities, C, instill confidence and reassurance, and D, have one eye on the future. And that's where I would be if I was a fire chief of today.
Well, I did like what you said about, you know, when you got multiple parties and, you know, it's about getting to the agreement on the what, on let's agree that this needs to be done. Let's agree that this issue, this problem, we need to make, you know, find a solution. We need to make safer. Let's agree on that. And once you agree on that, you got to let the leader figure out the how within reason, obviously.
To be honest, Berlin, I think you've got to be a little bit more granular. Everyone, no one can disagree. That's the sort of motherhood and apple pie. Of course, we'll want everyone to accept that. So,
I like that.
I think you've got to be a little bit more specific in fire terms.
Oh, I like that.
And what we've always, the world's fire problem, you know, this, the sort of industries that have been around forever. Fire, you know, the moment prehistoric man and woman discovered fire, the world changed. So it's always been a problem. You know, and if you look, what have we always done in history to deal with fire? What's worked? And it's sort of the same the world over. You know, this week we've commemorated the 80th anniversary of the D-Day landings. Now, the way we as an industry start to give the idea, how do we control things? Someone came up with a bright idea. Well, we'll have a plan. Great idea. But suddenly, not suddenly, but what we've done over time is create an industry that where plans have got bigger and bigger. And these plans that people have to write, a plan for this and a resilience plan and a this plan, an escalation plan. There's a plan for everything. And no one's any the wiser. And did prehistoric man have a 250-page plan? I don't think so. Did Emperor Nero, when he stopped Rome burning down, where they had no serious fires for 500 years, did he have a 250-page plan? Of course he didn't. When the Allies landed 80 years ago to retake Europe from the Nazi Germany hordes, how big was the plan? Because by most people's standards, that was probably quite a complicated operation to retake Europe from the Nazis. The plan was two pages long. And so I figure probably the answer isn't in more plans and more fire engineering and more regulations and more rules and more stuff. I think the answer is in less. And if you want everyone to have a common conversation, step one, you have to have a common language. You have to, otherwise you can't understand each other.
Agreed.
It's what Einstein called universality. So there's a famous quote about Charlie Chaplin, I love your humour because it's got universality. The whole universe finds you funny because your humour is easy for everybody to understand. It is universal. Fires are universal. A lithium battery doesn't know whether it's in Washington, Shanghai, Alberta. It doesn't care. So why have we got so many plans and so much stuff around fire? Because we've built layer and layer and layer and layer with the best of intention to try and bring consistency, to try and bring improved capability. But I think lithium batteries mean we need to cut through all that and go back to the basics. The basics are very simple principles. Nero set out the principles. What Nero did when Rome used to burn down frequently, he formed a dedicated fire force called the Vigilis, and slaves were given the freedom if they became part of this firefighting force. He passed the decree. Every home in Rome had to have a bucket of water by the cooking stove. So if the fire started, what did they do? They put it out immediately. If they didn't have a bucket of water, the Vigilis could enter the home at any time, day and night, check, And if they didn't have any water, you could drag them outside and flog them as a punishment and as an example to other homeowners. And then once the fire got beyond that initial attack capability, the Vigilis had their own fire force, and the first professional fire service in the world, really. Roll forward to what we did in Merseyside. You know, we knocked on the door. We asked, have you got wicked smoke alarms? What behaviours can we talk to you about to prevent the fire? If you have a fire, how do we give an early warning? What do you do to attack the fire? And if that doesn't work, how do you escape? And then what do we do? What is our aim as a fire service? And more recently, I've been doing a lot of work on waste sites. Again, the waste industry is as old as the fire industry. You back to prehistoric man, one of the first things they would do is dig a hole outside the camp to put waste. You know, the Greeks recycled metal. So waste and recycling have been, as an industry, been around forever. Their problem, lithium batteries in the waste chain. Yeah. So the challenge there is, how do we get a model that works for those guys? We've had to help them. How are you going to deal with it? Works for the fire departments in Seattle, Shanghai, Sydney, works all the world, and can be communicated to every single person in the world in a matter of seconds. A, you have a brand, and B, it has to have universality.
Yeah.
And so we came up with this brand called 02520.
Oh, yeah. Four numbers. Talk about that. 02520.
Yeah. 02520, we trademarked the brand, and it's very simple. Zero, you aim to get fires down to zero. Two, you detect them in two. Five, you attack them or deal with them in five or 20. You escape, leave your house, leave your business, but prepare for that 20-minute window for when the fire department arrive. What do they do to restore your life, your business, your home back to normal as quickly as possible? And then what you do is open up the door to conversations with the common language. So never mind NFPA standard 245B, subparagraph 18.4, you know, it was written on a Tuesday and then supported by UL 4932 and then the British standard this, and everyone's banging their head against the wall, or they've, you know, put themselves on Zoom and got them in a coffee. Everyone's switched off. Right, how are we going to prevent these fires? How are we going to detect them in two? Doesn't matter that this equipment meets UL standard 1894B.
Yeah.
Will it detect my fire in 2 minutes? That's a yes or no question.
Yeah.
I don't care about the wiring or the thickness of the rubber or the, you know, the make of the plastic or how many screws. I don't care about that.
Mm-hmm.
I care about, will it detect my fire in 2 minutes? That's, can I put this fire out in 5 minutes? Fire extinguishers are a great example. Fire extinguishers are just a chemical industry designed by chemists to sell chemicals. Who in the right mind, I've only ever been to one fire, one type of fire. It's red and it flickers and it has gases and all that. I don't know. There's different fuels and different gases give off.
Yeah.
Only one type of fire. Why have we created five or six types of fires? So that some poor sap had to spend their life, right? So is it a class A? Oh, can I use four? Yeah. All this stuff. One fire extinguisher should put it all out.
This being fire strategy should be simple to understand, to adopt and to measure. So the 02520, this is something that is should be emphasized to every homeowner, right? The citizens, to say we zero, meaning we do what we can, everything we can to prevent a fire from starting from the in the first place, obviously. Two is within 2 minutes, if you cannot prevent it, because not everything is 100% preventable. In theory, a lot of things are preventable, but within 2 minutes, there has to be a means of detecting. So the people know, the community is notified, someone is notified. Within 5 minutes, try to put out the fire. And then if all those, and all those measures aren't happening, then as a last measure, the fire department should be showing up within 20 to do what you were unable to do on your own. And that's the concept.
And that's the concept. And whether it's commercial or domestic, it's the same principle. So you only learn the principle once.
Yes.
The difference would be prevention in a commercial context is a lot more about maintenance and housekeeping and all those things.
Yeah.
And detection is much more about hardware and systems.
Yeah.
Whereas in a domestic context, it's about people, really. Something smells funny. You can hear a funny noise, or you spot something's really touched, something's really hot. It's not there's lots of clues in your home,
yeah.
Particularly when lithium batteries, you know. There's lots, where do you charge your lithium battery? And if that did go into thermal runaway, would you, you know, could you go and do it in the garage, or could you do it somewhere else? Or, you know, that 5 minutes attack, what have you got? How many people have got a fire extinguisher? Now, if you went to most fire departments, could you sell me a fire extinguisher, or could you tell me a good one to buy? Most fire departments will give a brochure. Oh, well, there's four classes of fire. Suddenly, the homeowner's saying, oh, no, what do I do? So they don't bother. And then that 20-minute window, there were lots of things a homeowner could do. And when I spent a week with Phoenix, at the time, Brunstein had written a book called Customer Service.
Yes.
And it was just the most amazing. If people haven't read it, I strongly urge any leader to read it. It's a fantastic piece of work. But it's about that window of time you've got to protect your life when the fire department arrives. They're going to probably use a lot of water. Ask them before the fire, do you use textiles? And my car's on fire. Instead of putting it out with water, are you going to use a fire blanket? If not, why not? You know, why are you using billions of litres of water when a fire blanket will put it out without damaging the environment? You know, be customers of the fire service for that 20-minute window. And I think Phoenix were masters at that. And it feels like a little bit of that has been lost in search of data and in search of bigger initiatives. So in a commercial environment, it's really clear, you know. I think one of the challenges we have in the fire service is engaging the strategic leadership as a business. Most boards or executives will say, well, you know, of course we're committed. Safety is our number one priority. That's the usual corporate life. Safety is our number one priority. And the second one is safety is at the heart of everything we do. So how much money do you spend on safety? Sorry? How much money do you actually spend compared to other parts of your budget? And that's a good indicator. And zero injuries, zero fires, is that realistic? Because with lithium batteries, it's impossible. There's no way you can guarantee. It used to be pretty realistic.
Sure.
So it's about, so the formula is we have the ABC of fire safety equals 0 to 520. So the ABC is active participation. Everybody in the home or everybody in the business should take their part actively in trying to prevent fires. The B, balance. We're going back to Arthur Ashe, you know, balance reality with ambition. Stop, don't have ridiculous targets that are never going to be achieved. You know, we aim to have zero fires ever. No, they're not going to happen now.
Right.
I'm going to put water cannon. I'm going to put 100 water cannon on my waysite. Have you got the money? No, but at some point I will have. You know, let's talk real.
Yeah.
And then the C, improved capability of people and equipment.
Yeah.
So what budget have I got? What is the best I can do with that budget? Work back, you know, and it's the same philosophy as Arthur Ashe. Start from where you are.
Yeah, there you go.
Do what you can with what you got. Active participation, balanced reality and ambition, improved capability equals zero, prevent five, detecting two, attacking five, and over 20.
Oh, I love it. Question. Question, but I'm going to go back a little bit for those that didn't hear, but the book that the chief was talking about, or the Alan Brunicini book, is The Essential of Fire Department Customer Service. Yes, it's a great book, great read. Every firefighter should read that book, right? It's a master of customer service, and at the end of the day, they are basic concepts. They're easy concepts to follow. You just have to abide by them, learn them, and put them into play. So thank you for that recommendation. We do recommendations of books and other podcasts and shows, so that is a great one. Thank you. What I also heard was, which I loved, I've heard someone say, be customers of the fire service within the first 20 minutes of a fire, like going to, obviously, to the 02520, which is awesome, right? Like, we all should be, even us at home, right? Firefighter, day off, I'm a customer of the fire service, right? If I need something, I can call 911. So being the best customer that we can be proactively in the first 20 minutes of not just a fire, but of any incident, if you will. So I love that. So my next question here, Chief, is, well, it's two questions. Well, I'll ask the first one first. What happens when every citizen in every community adopts 02520?
Well, hopefully you'll have less fires that have been traditionally predictable, which are effectively cooking, predominantly cooking and a bit of wiring, but it's mainly cooking, isn't it? But I think the volume and frequency will be compensated for by lithium battery fans, you know. And so I think probably the volume will be pretty similar. Hopefully, it won't. And there'll be less fires and less need for a fire service in its current form. And that's when I'm saying all about relevance. I think the fire service has so many skills and assets to offer a wider agenda. The number one priority facing the world is climate change. The fire service is at the forefront of those incidents that are the fallout from that, whether it's floods, weather storms, snow, bushfire, wildfire, you know, whatever it is, the fire service is really, really engaged. And on a regulatory point of view, all of our regulatory work is around smoking, kitchen fire, you know, it has no regard to lithium batteries. I don't think you'll find any guideline written by any government agency that actually mentions lithium battery fires yet. And yet, most fire department websites is the number one risk. So, on the other side of the coin, the environment agencies are all the regulation about environment, regulation. And they're really good at that side of things, but tend not to be brilliant at response. They can't mobilize in the same speed with the same sort of public buy-in as the fire service. So what if you just start, instead of Homeland Security, Homeland Safety as an agency, and you merged environment and fire in the future and said there's actually one agency, part of which does regulation and part of which does response. So it doesn't matter whether it's a flood, storm, fire, bushfire, whatever, there's one response agency that you get used to being your 02520 agency. Because 02520 applies to all of those. Yeah. So in a bushfire, it's probably in hours. What are you going to do in your 2 hours, your 5 hours, your 20 hours? In a storm or an earthquake or something like that, again, it's probably in hours. But in recovery terms, it's probably weeks or months. You know, the model can be scaled up and down to any form of... You only need to learn one strategy.
Yeah.
And it, you know, I think the idea of merging fire and environment, you know, is something that if I were the fire chief for the US, I'd be really. Someone will come over with it. So the one to the table first gets to control the deal, you know. And if I were the fire chief, I'd be controlling the pack.
Yeah.
At least think about that as a model, because your point is very valid about impact on resources. What is the role of the fire service now? I think the American Fire Service was way more visionary in the UK by going for first responder, that sort of that medical response agenda. Trouble with that agenda, it's caught up in politics, and again, it's caught up in money. You know, it's become such an intricate part of fire and rescue services. You know, the bottom line is really affected. You know, fire chiefs now need a really deep understanding of medical response at every level, financial, cultural, community. I don't know. It feels like environments are more important, potentially important agenda for the future.
Yeah.
So I just think at least, you know, the Vision 2020 conversation led to community risk reduction. What's Vision 2030? I've not heard anybody talk about 2030. Huh. We were talking about 2020 in 2004 or five, you know, 2002, 8 years off. We're already, you know, the pandemic sort of clipped all of our wings, but we're already closer to 2030. And what does it look like for the US?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the US is in a great place, actually. You've got an administrator who's very visionary, got a strong background in community. Lawyers also got a really strong background in trade unions. The model of today is much more collaborative. Yeah. I think it needs with, you know, I worked in a period, my change was, it was a different model.
Yeah.
I think the model and the culture of our employees today is much more collaborative. I think the idea of pushing quite hard is more difficult, and it's probably not contemporary with today. But I think the idea of clear vision and bite-sized vision, 02520, you know, our young leaders today will understand.
Yeah.
What they won't do nowadays is read a 200-page NFPA guidance document, or, you know, a 20-page blueprint for the future.
Agreed.
Just, People just don't do it. We're TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, whatever it's called nowadays. You know, the buyer needs a soundbite, and that's so that's why we trademarked. You know, the idea is we're talking with one Canadian fighter pilot who won a First Nations program. So, look, can we use the license? $100 a year, have it. You know, we're not talking thousands of dollars, but I think having a payment means whoever is the recipient will take it seriously. If you give it away, it's treated as a gift. If people have to invest in it, whatever that figure is, usually they have to go and ask permission for that money. Yeah. However, even if it's only $100, Billing, but that process generates thought.
Yep.
How are you going to use this initiative? Great. You know, and $100 is not going to put anybody, or shouldn't put anybody off. But so that's the logic behind making it a brand.
Agreed.
It'd be great. Anybody's got an interest, that, you know, hopefully you can share my email. It's just
yes. Well, we will. At the very end here, we're going to find out more on how we can learn about 02520, about the initiative, about the project, about how. But we'll dive into that in a little bit, because I want to know a little bit more about where it is now, but how can people learn more about it and adopt more of it? So, Chief, you have obviously been a fire chief. You said you worked in many different fire services in different countries, if you will, four in the United Kingdom specifically, but you've done work around the world, around the globe. There's got to be something out there, and I know there is, but we're going to ask you for one. As a leader, Chief, what's non-negotiable for you?
Putting the community first for everybody, you know, and it sounds a little bit sort of glib, but sometimes it does take some doing in the fire service. You know,
I agreed, because it is one thing. I want you to elaborate more, because it is one thing.
I'll give you an example. So one of the issues we observed in when we started our community fire safety project, we noticed that. There are certain factors that are common in serious fire injury. Age, the older you are, the more difficult it is to run away. Mobility is an issue. Drink, drugs, presence of alcohol and smoking are issues. And general health. The more people think about their health, probably the more they're likely to think about their safety. The two seem to inherently go hand in hand. So then that means if we're going to truly reduce fires, we've got to sort of get into a health agenda, because if we believe healthier people are less prone to fire, then the more healthy we can make our community, then the less fires we're going to have. So what does that mean? Well, it means every firefighter comes to work. We've all got brilliant gyms in our fire station, that is amazing buildings. And yet we lock the doors at night. And we look out the window and throw our head, oh, the homelessness problem is appalling. All these homeless, somebody should do something. Meanwhile, we've locked the doors on an engine room that could easily take 50 or 60 beds for a night. We've got hot showers. We've got a kitchen. What if we open the door? How's this for now? We'll open the door. We'll get a load of camp beds. We'll get our mobile decontamination unit, which has got showers in it. We'll get some volunteers. And in a really cold winter's night, all them homeless guys can come into our fire station, have a warm bed, safe environment, get a shower and get some food. What if we did that?
Interesting.
On our 30 fire stations. So if each one took 50, we've just taken 1,500 homeless people off the streets. We just made them feel like somebody cares. Yeah. You've got all these firefighters, so security isn't an issue. What's an issue? The restaurants will donate the food. We've already paid for the building. It costs absolutely nothing. What if, instead of the firefighters pumping iron in the gym, what if we opened it up to the community and called it a community gym that's also used by firefighters? So if you've had a heart attack, or you're trying to rehabilitate, the last thing you need is to go to your local muscle gym and look at all these guys pumping iron, doing the thing you're never going to do. What you want is a gym that you can be a bit private in and just, you know, improve your health at your own pace, out of the glare of these superhuman Navy SEALs. And, you know, just, you might just be a bit old and a bit fat. You just want to get a bit fitter. So why not do that in your local fire station?
Wow.
And what else? What if we had some dance classes in our fire station. Got the kids involved. Wow. And do some fun stuff where they see the fire station. And, you know, what if we had cooking lessons using our kitchen and got some local chefs to teach people how to cook healthily? In fact, what if there is nothing you could suggest, as long as it makes people healthier and fitter, that is what we should do in our fire station, if we believe we're putting the community first.
Wow.
And that's what we might sometimes, and we did all that 20 years ago. So much so that the Prime Minister, who's now our Foreign Secretary, David Cameron, came to visit us and he said, I love this idea. What do you need from me? I said, we need $10 million to build a brand new fire station where everything about the fire service is at the back and everything about the community is at the front. And so we built the fire station in the most socially deprived, gang-ridden area of Liverpool with money that the government gave. So it's called the Firefit Hub. So go online, have a look at it.
Oh, my gosh, this exists. This exists.
Oh, yeah.
All right,
yeah.
So what's the website? Tell us what the website is so we can
listen. So the website, give me 2 seconds. I'll just...
Sure.
Find, it's Toxteth. If you search T-O-X-T-E-T-H...
Okay.
Firefit, F-I-R-E, F-I-T... Hub.
Wow. This exists. I'm looking it up now.
Yep. A place to be you.
So say that out loud again for the listeners. T-O-X.
So T-O-X-T-E-T-H. T-O-X-T-E-T-H. Space. Firefit. F-I-R-E-F-I-T. Space.
Oh, there it is. I spelled it completely wrong. I got it right here. I'm going to look this up. Wow. So this exists. Was this your idea, Chief?
Yeah, well, basically, when we had the Olympics, we tried to get all fire services part of... So the reason the UK wanted the Olympics was really about improving fitness and health in the community. It wasn't just about the sport. You know, what's in it for the community? So I felt the fire service should be a part of that. So
Wow. All
fire chiefs signed up to this idea of going the extra mile. We tried to get gyms open and so there was a lot of activity using the firefighter brand as a health and wellness brand.
Wow.
And firefighter facilities as health and wellness facility. So there was no idea was too imaginative to be dismissed. We had a fire station in the middle of a gang war. And we brought in a theatre group to act out Romeo and Juliet on the fire station.
Wow.
Which is effectively the story of a gang war. And, you know, it wasn't easy, but it really made a difference to the way that community engaged. Now, it would be harder now than it was, you know, more guns. This was 2005, more guns. But my point is, unleash the imagination of firefighters and you might be surprised what comes out. You know, we got a lot of firefighters being attacked. And so we basically got a trailer with a big barbecue on the back and we just drove into the community, just set up and just waiting for the kids to come around and have a burger. And then we had a lot of fire dogs out there, you know. What kid doesn't love a dog? So they'll come and chat, well, see, there's a fire dog. What does he do? They can detect arson and they can sniff out flammable vapor. Oh, I didn't know you used dogs. Well, have you ever thought of a career in the fire service? Well, no. What's, you know, rather than sitting on the fire station waiting for the call, go out to the community and engage.
Wow.
Put the community first.
So, community first. I've heard that all day today. It's awesome. So let me ask 2 questions. I think you answered it, but I'm going to clarify. Who funded this project and how successful is it? Like, I know successful is a very subjective way to measure, but who funded and how do you measure success?
The local fire authority funded it. When the government changed the national law to incentivize every fire department giving away free smoke alarms, they put $100 million on the table.
I see.
That every fire department could bid for, providing the fire department matched funding. So if you wanted, you wanted to buy 100,000 smoke alarms, the fire department had to, you know, of government money, you had to find 100,000 fire department money. Wow. And it just signaled, but the reality is, what does it cost? You know, time. We've got our biggest assets, time. We've got firefighters with time that's already paid for. Our buildings are paid for. And if a fire department's got no money, do what you can with what you've got. If the answer is I've got no money, how many firefighters you've got? Ask them what skills, how many teachers, how many plumbers, you know, how many, what skills have you got already starting your fire department? You might be surprised. And what could we do with that that costs us nothing? And if we want to do something, we haven't got the money, go to a local restaurant or go to Amazon or go and find a business that will pay for it. You know, people love to be associated with a fire brand. And if it's meaningful and it's part of a bigger agenda and they can understand it. So you say, look, we've got strategy 02520. What we're trying to do is help people prevent cooking fires. And what we want to do is this. We're going to need $250. Costco are brilliant at funding projects like that. And what we'll do, we'll bring the fire truck and we'll say, Costco supporting Seattle's 02520 agenda. Thank you, Costco. The local press will come down. We'll go on TV. They'll love it.
Wow. This is amazing. I'm at the website now. I'm looking at it and my mind's already, it's already racing to see what kind of projects we can adopt or start talking about. This is absolutely phenomenal. It's still open today.
I'll give you a challenge then, Berlin.
Yes,
when
please,
you speak to your firefighters,
yes,
ask them, say, look, in 30 seconds, explain to me what community risk reduction means to you, because they're your ambassador. They're your sales team,
yep,
those firefighters. And if they can't explain it to you in 30 seconds, how on earth can they explain it to the community?
Mm.
And if they say, oh, it's an NFPA standard, straight away, oh, the community will fall, you know. And I don't mean to be dismissive. Those standards are important in certain areas.
Right.
When you're trying to get human behavior at the center of your aim, your strategy, an NFPA standard is never going to cut it.
It's not,
you know, you need to be. So if you say, well, if I give you four letters, 02520, boom, 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 prevent, detecting two, attacking 520, does that mean something to you? Yeah, that's what we do all the time. Absolutely.
Wow.
So what we're going to do is unlock. So when you speak to the community, don't talk about underpinning what we're doing. That's what community is. But at the top, that sort of the key message is we're doing 02520 with them, not to them.
Wow. With them. That's the key. With, not to.
Yeah.
Well, since we're in
the
challenges,
community know their place in that conversation. Then, don't they? So the 025 bits yours, the 20 bits a joint problem.
That's amazing. How many of these gyms are there in the area?
Well, in Merseyside Fire Service, there was, well, every fire station had the gym. I've been retired. There's still so the fire pit hub. I think it's about four of them in Merseyside where they've rebuilt a fire station. They've built it. But in truth, I mean, that was lovely. It was a really great initiative.
Right.
If we hadn't got the money from government to do it, then we wouldn't have been able to, we'd have had to do it differently.
Sure.
But every fire department's got an engine house. And every engine house can be used for dance, or you can put a boxing ring in it and have a boxing club, or you can have, you know, the gym on the open. Most fire stations have got a gym on it, or just do a fitness session, drive the fire engine out to the school. Brunacina was a great example in Phoenix. 30 years ago, they went and did a fitness class with the local school kids, you know, because most fire departments have a fitness part of the day, the shift.
Yes.
So why not go to a school and do it with the community together?
Wow. Powerful. Wow.
So
love this.
Inspire them rather than sit in the fire station and do it in your own gym. Now, again, these are really big steps for firefighters to take.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for some, it's okay to say no on day one.
Sure.
You know, day two. But over time, if the strategic intent of the business is that is our purpose,
wow,
then you've either got to get on board or get out. You know, that's the world has changed around you. And what we can't do is just go back. You know, the firefighter isn't the customer of the fire service.
Yes.
You know, can you imagine Amazon saying, well, if the employees say, well, we don't like using robots to deliver parcels, better say, well, of course you won't use robots. No, you don't like it. Why would I use robots if you guys don't like it? Yeah. That would never happen.
Right.
Wow. You know, someone goes in and says to McDonald's, I don't like gherkins. Oh, well, let's not use gherkins because you don't like gherkins. You know, it's customers need choices. And I think fire departments have got to sort of smell the coffee a little bit.
We're talking challenges and we've got great ideas. Give us one more, Chief. We just talked about community gyms. We just talked about welcoming the communities into our spaces instead of us waiting for them to call for us to go to them. You talked about going in and doing PT with the communities, with the schools, instead of just doing it behind our closed doors at our fire stations. Great, great concepts, ideas. Give us one more thing for our fire stations, our firefighters to go do, something that they could do today.
Well, I'll give you one for the leaders, to be honest, because in fairness, you know, I've been pretty sort of robust about the role of the firefighter. I think the other one is say thank you well. You know, signal great performance, best of them. In the fire service, in any organisation to sort of change and direct behaviour, you need sanctions and rewards. You know, that doesn't mean punishments, but you've got to sort of recognize poor behavior or the way you don't want the organization to go. You've got to encourage and promote good behavior. So I'll give you an example.
Yep.
We had a really high level of sickness. Firefighters in Liverpool had a much higher level of sickness than most other fire departments. And that suggests to me there's a culture of people booking sick when in other organizations, they probably wouldn't book sick with a cold or whatever. So how do you signal you want change? And how do you reward change? When people say, you know what, I'm going to come with you. And so we signal by saying, look, that if you consistently and continuously have lots and lots of leave, sick leave, we're really going to spend time looking at why. What is happening in your life that you're always, because we're paying you to be at work. And if you're never at work, then that's not a great investment. So we need to really, really focus on you. Specifically you, and make it really clear to that person they're going to receive a lot of attention. On the other side of the coin, oh, you guys over here are brilliant attendees, but most of you never have a day off work sick. You are fantastic. So what we're going to do with you guys, at the end of the year, if you want to go in this draw, it's not compulsory, but if you want to go in a draw, anybody who's had no sickness can go in a draw to win a free car. So we're going to give away a free car, and the eligibility to go in the raffle for the car is you've never had any sickness this year. And that's our way of saying thank you. So you've all got the chance to win a car. Now, the fire chief can't go in the draw. I can go in the sanction bit, but I can't go in the draw, and I wouldn't want to because I've got to lead by example. And great way of signaling thank you. You say thank you by giving something meaningful and trust people. You know, credit cards. Give a corporate credit card and then don't pour over the bill. You know, if you trust your employees, then trust them to spend your budget. You know, give them tap and pay. You know, to earn trust, you've got to give trust. How many fire departments and organizations say, there's a credit card? If you steal them or nick it, that's just a criminal offence with the police. But why would you? I know you're a great employee. I trust you. Why? You know, can you imagine pouring over your wife or your partner's credit card bill the way finance departments pour over credit card statements from fire officers or firefighters? That's even if they even get a card in the first place. So it's at every level, try to be nice and treat people as you would want to be treated yourself. Genuinely.
So question on that. So I love it how you were talking about, like, you know, you're speaking to the leaders now. You're talking about if you have an employee, you're looking at a group of employees, and a lot of them have been using, say, a ton of sick leave. You're going to go out and find out why. You're going to go have conversations. You really want to invest your time and energy in finding out what it is that you could do to help these individuals and find out how you can help them not use so much sick leave, because you're right, it's not a very good investment if you're not at work. We want everyone to be at work. But on the flip side, you mentioned for those that are always showing up, they're showing up to work all the time, they never use sick leave, they have all these time on the books, and you want to incentivize them. So two things. It is great that, you know, these great attendees are not using up their sick leave, but would that encourage those that are maybe sick to start not calling in sick because now they're showing up to work unwell when they should be at home? But number two is, how do you incentivize with that budget? You said a car, for example. Who provides that stuff?
So I'll run through the economics first because it is often a question. So to cover for, I have a 13% sick pool of people. So I employed roughly 200 firefighters purely to cover for sickness absence. Now, if I could get that absence down to 1%, I saved the salaries of 200 firefighters a year, which at $80,000... is millions of dollars. Now, a car would cost me $100,000. So in net terms, I'm millions of dollars in pocket.
I see.
By getting sickness down to 1% from 13%.
Sure, that's huge.
And then what I can do is I have physio, free physio. I have counseling. I have all these health initiatives to help people get back to work.
Wow.
And then the total figure, if we collect as an organization, don't reduce sickness by an amount, 1 or 2%, not 30%, but an amount, then none of it kicks in. So suddenly, the guy in your shift, you know, every time there's a baseball match and they're at work, unbelievably, I don't know how illness works, but unbelievably, they got an allergy to working when the baseball team, and I'm not in the fire brigade now. Of course, they're taking what we call taking the mickey. And we know it, you know it, every firefighter out there, every leader knows it. So that mickey taking, that's got to stop. But the only people who are going to stop it are the colleagues of that person.
Yes.
Because as managers, you know, you say, how dare you suggest I'm not sick? You know, you're not a doctor. You get into this noise about the health problem. And the bigger picture is these people are undermining our collective pride in our organization. Most people are incredibly proud. I was, you are, and I know every firefighter I've ever come across is incredibly proud to be a firefighter. And those people who manipulate the system undermine all of our pride. And it's on all of us to solve the problem.
Yes.
But how do you make it everyone's problem? Because unlocking the reward is a collective, starting point is a collective view. So you create cultural conversations at every level, face to face, on watches, on shifts, on fire department stations. So I'm not very happy about this now. I wouldn't mind the chance of winning a car. You're now really causing me a problem. You know, I've noticed you're off every time the Red Sox are playing at home. Is that coincidence?
Or the Mariners. You know
what I mean? So it's trying to provoke on these conversations. So there's one about giving away a car.
So question, way, you had the leeway. You as the fire chief had the ability to do that. Like you, it was your budget, obviously. But
no,
you...
I had to go and argue the case to the authority.
Okay, obviously. Okay.
And I just set the indicators we had to meet to unlock the budget to pay for the car. So we had to save the money first before we could buy the car.
Of course.
But in truth, Berlin... sickness dropped from 30% to 2% in about 3 weeks.
So it dropped.
It worked
significantly. Yeah. It worked.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah. So when you ask about what paid for all these alarms, I had millions of dollars to spare. And no impact on fire car.
Wow. How many cars did you give away over the years?
Seven.
Is that program still going now?
It kept going for about 2 years after I retired. But in fairness, I retired in 2012, 2013. The world had moved on, you know.
Sure.
I don't think it would be possible in today's climate, but I think other things are. And my point is, how do you say thank you? And often it's just as simple as writing a letter to someone to say thank you.
Love that piece.
An email. You know, I think... words are incredibly powerful. You know, it doesn't...
Sure.
Being able to give a very frank piece of feedback to someone about poor performance can be challenging for our managers. Because the language of today, not everyone's got the language skills to sort of give straight feedback.
Yeah.
And equally, the language of reward. So we had a program, and we stole a lot of it from the US. There's a problem about character, and it's about describing traits of character in the good and the bad. So, you know, positive versus negative, fair versus unfair, you know, and language to describe what does that mean. And it was a really useful tool for our managers to give them components. So rather than saying you're always late, you know, you say, look, I'm really struggling with your view of timeliness. And what I mean by timeliness is this, and it's a huge, you know, to be able to better describe the input I'm concerned about, not the fact that you were late. What were the behaviors that led to you being late? And so we invested a lot of time in being able to give people the language tools to say, I'm really pleased with your performance, I'm not so pleased. And encouraging people to write to people at the home address or at the workplace, and just a letter where someone's physically written and said, I'm so pleased, mate, the way you behaved. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I guarantee that person will have that letter till the day they die.
Absolutely. To, at the very minimum, for the remainder of their career and yes. beyond. I love that. So I'll highlight what you said. As a leader, how do you say thank you to your employees, to your subordinates, to your peers, to your friends, to your, you know, to your people. So
yeah.
I love that piece. Okay. We've just spent a lot of time talking about how to do this, how to become better, how to deliver more service. Let's offer continued action items, Chief, because that's what this is about. This is about engaging the people to do something more today, just a little bit more. Doesn't have to be extravagant measures, to just continue to become better. So if you're talking to a newer firefighter, Chief, what would you suggest to those individuals to start doing to either grow as leaders themselves or to deliver an above and beyond customer service experience to others?
I guess be curious about the what if. What if we did do that, or what if we didn't do that? You know, it's like the stuff we're talking about. What if we did open our fire department and put 100 beds in there and took 100 homeless people off the street? What's the worst that could happen? You know, what if we did? And just ask the question. You know, I think that's really promoting it, an open conversation about, well, what if? You know, we have these amazing people, these amazing resources. What if we used them in this way? What if we did this with them? And the more you ask that, the more it becomes an organizational habit.
An organizational habit. That's key. So, I mean, you drove home, always ask the what if. So this next piece, if it's any different, if you're talking to a leader in an organization, maybe we'll say a company officer, right? Not the fire chief quite yet, but you're talking to a company officer in the fire service. What can they do to increase their level of customer service to the community?
I guess they're sort of middle management sat on fire stations. What if every shift we had a conversation about, you know, the last incident, what could we have done together to give that customer a different experience, a better experience? And what if, where does 02520 apply? Does the model work in the UK? What was the zero? You know, how did they detect the problem in 2 minutes? Did they do anything in five? If not, what could they have done? It's just being curious about having a framework against which to measure some of these what if questions, you know, because otherwise it just becomes a question for the sake of a question. You know, what if they'd done this, would they achieve the zero? What if they'd done that, would they achieve the five? You know, what if they'd not escaped? What if it had been lifting instead of a cooking fire? You know, well, what can we do about that? And I think it's just getting this sort of day-to-day curiosity, really.
Yeah, curiosity, reflection, and how to become a little better. That's what yeah. I heard. That's perfect.
And fun. You know, this is the best job in the world. You know, it should be. Tragedy and all that to one side. It's also an incredible privilege and incredible fun. You're great colleagues. It's a great job. The public value you. You know, we're very, very, very lucky and very privileged. And I think appreciating that along the way is really important as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you. Okay, now we are talking to chiefs, chief officers of an organization, the fire chief themselves. What's one thing that they could do to, again, foster or create more and higher level of customer service?
I think it's focused on how much of my budget is spent on improving the customer experience.
Wow.
You know what? Well, if I say, you know, is it 10%? What is that figure? What is that figure? And am I happy with that? Is it reasonable? Is it proportionate?
Wow.
And if not, what am I going to do about it?
That's amazing. Okay, here we go. Listeners challenge here, Chief. You challenged me. You challenged the listeners. Challenge the listeners, all the listeners, regardless of their rank, tenure, fire service or not, to grow as leaders, to foster a better environment for customer service to be at a higher level for all.
I'd ask them to reflect on the concept of 02520. Does it cover all we need? You know, and is it the sort of D-Day, two-day plan, a two-page plan? Do we really need all this documentation, all of these standards? And if we don't think we do as fire officers, then isn't it time we spoke up? You know, isn't it time we said, actually, if you're going to put a best system in, as long as there's tons of water, you know, whatever, that's between you and the manufacturer, you know, but as a fire officer, I want plenty of water and I want to be able to understand the problem. You know, I think it's just not be seduced by the sort of regulatory rhetoric. Just be true to your, and does 02520 give you that truth as a firefighter? And if it does, let me know. And if it doesn't, why not? I'd love to continue that conversation because I think it's really important to have a universality about our collective truth. Why are we here?
Yes.
And what are we working with the customer to try and achieve, whether it's domestic or commercial?
I love these conversations, Chief. And you mentioned it, you know, you love to discuss. I love the fact that you're just saying, hey, let's discuss more. If you have a question, email me. So let's go with that. What's your website and or your email address so the listeners here can reach out to you or find you online or contact you if needed?
LinkedIn, I'll always respond to a LinkedIn request. Email, it's McGuirk, McGuirk tony@gmail.com. There's no website up about 02520 yet, because to be honest, we're busy doing it.
Yeah.
And you know, we're just figuring out what would we use a website to do. And I need these types of conversations to say, well, before you go to a website, what is it that people are interested in? What are the questions? And you know, I think there's a little bit of work to do to not be constantly updating a website. You know what I mean? So there will be soon, and we've got the web domain name, obviously, but you know, we will have, so there is no web domain, just give us an email and it'd be great to chat.
All right. This is my favorite piece, Chief. We're here today because someone challenged you and said that Tony McGuirk, Chief Tony McGuirk, would be a phenomenal guest to share concepts on leadership on the show. So now we get to ask you, Chief, is there someone out there you would like to challenge for us to reach out to help us continue leadership to leave the fire service in a better place tomorrow?
There's a guy, I will email you his contact, Tom Wizorski. And Tom, there's an organization called the Center for Public Safety Excellence, CPSE.
Oh, yeah.
Tom was one of he was the first chief executive. He was one of the main guys who started the whole idea up. He then went working for the City Managers Association. He's been a fire chief, a police chief. He's recently been ordained as a Catholic priest of some kind. He's got an incredible story to tell and has a very sort of strategic background in public sector, police and fire. So I think you'd be a great guest.
Oh,
offline,
goodness.
I will email you a contact if that's
awesome.
If that's helpful, Bill.
Please, please. His name was?
Tom Wizorski.
Thank you so much. And it's because of leaders like yourself, Chief, that are willing to help us further the conversation. So thank you. So before we close the kitchen table here, Chief, how about this? Lasting leadership thoughts that you would like to leave our listeners with on top of everything you've talked to us about today?
I guess it's be authentic. You know, it's very, very easy to have the courage of your conviction when you've got a conviction. If you haven't got a conviction about what you're trying to lead the organization towards or what you're trying to lead the organization to achieve, are you really leading? You know what I mean? Achieving the UL94 stuff, it's not really, you know, it doesn't make you passionate. Probably it's not the organization for you, you know? And just be really truthful with yourself about that.
I mean, authentic is key in any leader. Thank you so much, Chief, for providing your context, your message, your philosophies, and your perspective on leadership. We haven't talked so much about community risk reduction. In fact, the one individual that did talk on community risk reduction was Ben May himself. This was a lovely conversation regarding customer service and how we can become better as a fire service. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in today to The Kitchen Table. We truly hope that you found this time valuable. Hope that we've inspired you to take action, to lead, and to spread leadership conversation. Till next time, be safe, be intentional, stay curious.